Each week, the Village Voice carries a cartoon strip titled Stan Mack's Real Life Funnies. Stan Mack is with me now. Mack's strips carry the guarantee, all dialogue reported verbatim. The conversations the people in his strips have are all quoted from dialogue Stan Mack has overheard. One recent strip spoofed what he overheard in the audio control room during a Billy Joel concert. Another was the interplay between the director and actors during the filming of a scene for a pornographic movie set in an urban park. Stan Mack has an ear for the absurd conversations that you unintentionally find yourself eavesdropping on in trains, bars, or restaurants, where you can tell a person is trying to pick someone up or impress them, or is unreeling a tangled story of a recent affair. Mack graduated from the Rhode Island School of Design in 1958. He worked at the New York Herald Tribune as art director of their Sunday Book Review, and at the New York Times as the art director of several departments, including the Sunday Magazine section. During the early years of the National Lampoon, he did the cartoon Mule's Diner. He's been doing his real-life strip since 1974, and he's also the co-author of a new book of cartoons called In Search of the G-Spot. It's a sex spoof. In one cartoon, a teenager is saying to her mother in disbelief, "Really, Mom? They didn't have G-spots when you were a teenager?" Stan Mack, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Your career seems to have gone in the reverse of a lot of people's, because you started in mainstream newspapers, the Herald Tribune, the New York Times, and then you started working for underground papers and doing a, quote, underground strip. How did that change come about?
Well, that's true. I think it's probably because of my age, mostly. I was there before the 60s hit us all, and so I was just trying to become a commercial artist. But somewhere in the back of my head were some of these odd little pictures, which I discovered were also in the heads of a lot of other people, some years younger. And I began to get this feeling that I should be doing some of these things, and discovered at the same time that there was a market, but there were odd little markets downtown instead of in Midtown where I was working with my tie and my jacket, and decided to take them down there. And gradually discovered that I had a kind of an odd view of things which fit. It wasn't the underground of Robert Crumb exactly, but it was about the same time, and there was a sort of a feeling, a way of expressing nonverbal things for the most part in the early years that I was able to do.
When you were working at newspapers, did you find there were a lot of ideas that you couldn't get in?
Well, it was two worlds. The newspaper world was simply the commercial art world, although even that began to change at the Herald Tribune. But the ideas I was doing on my own had no direct connection with that.
How did you start your real-life funnies?
I was working at the Times buying art, and I enjoyed buying art, bought a lot of illustration and photography, and liked the idea of sending people on assignment. But for the most part, those were photographers. And since I was interested in illustration, I thought more illustrators should be used that way, and did try it a couple of times, and it was a lot of fun. Then I decided I want to go back out and be an artist myself, back out in the sense of leaving the 9-to-5 world, and thought that the only way I could initiate projects on my own, since I wasn't basically a writer, was to try to combine those two things and see if I could sell the idea to editors, that I could go out and do, I could cover events, I could do things that wouldn't require that I go along with a writer. It was a way of creating a package.
Now, what about the idea of overhearing dialogue and reporting it verbatim?
That I stumbled on by chance. It really happened once when I went out with a writer from the Times. Her name was Georgia DeLay, and she's quite a good writer who's on the staff of the Times now. And I went with her to cover garden club ladies visiting corporate boardrooms in Connecticut. Instead of going to people's gardens and homes one week, they decided to go corporate. And I went along with her to illustrate her piece and ended up doodling, in addition to doodles, doodling words, which I overheard. Afterwards, I discovered that she enjoyed my quotes, and suddenly the idea occurred to me, why can't I put my quotes along with my sketches? And in fact, we did illustrate her piece that way, and the idea was born.
Do you remember some of the other first cartoons you did in that style?
That was pretty much it until I went to The Voice. Once or twice, I tried it again with The Times because I knew people there and they were comfortable with the idea of my doing this sort of thing. But then I went to Milton Glaser and Clay Felker, who were recreating The Voice, restyling it and so on. And it happened coincidentally that they were looking to start a page of cartoons. And so they were looking to fill it with kind of New York-oriented stuff. They didn't know what exactly, and I didn't know what I was talking about either. But I said, I can go around the places. And one of the first places I went to was Bloomingdale's. And I'll hang out and write down what people say and draw what they look like and come back and do something. We didn't know what it was. We didn't know it was going to be in panels. We thought it might be one big picture. And I've said that they did it more in a spirit of adventure than that they knew what I was talking about. But that's what happened. I went to Bloomingdale's, felt very sneaky, did not get anybody's permission, certainly didn't feel like a reporter, and hung around there until I would make people nervous, and then I would move on to another department. But I took notes. I would edge up to people who were talking to salespeople and listen in on what they said. And wrote it down.
So what did you get from that visit? What was the strip like?
And I did one called Bloomingdale's. And since everybody in New York, any of the readers, would know Bloomingdale's, it was an easy one to start with because they could identify easily.
Do you remember the dialogue?
I don't, but it was silly stuff that took place in the cosmetics area and things like, or women helping men shop for men's clothes. They were, in a sense, cheap shots. They were easy things to go after.
Well, your strip has become now a combination of ordinary and exotic situations. In the exotic situations, I'd put the scenes that you overheard while a pornographic film was being shot in Central Park. How did you get hooked up with that?
I have a friend who was a film editor, and she is trying to get as much experience as she can and trying very hard to get into the mainstream of film editing and directing. But one way she's gaining her experience is to work on some porno shots, films. So she told me about that. And I went along with those people in a van up to Central Park. It was such a funny idea to shoot porno in Central Park. And what they claimed to me, because they knew I was writing things down, that they had some kind of permission from the city. I'm sure that wasn't true. And it became more and more obvious as they whipped that little van all around these roads trying to avoid the police cars until they found a place which was hidden from view pretty much by shrubs, except for people like joggers who would appear occasionally and little kids who would wander through.
So they had a lookout system, people watching for joggers and police?
That's right. I made the lookout system myself. Sometimes I'll simplify these stories just because of the space available. But we had a few people out with walkie-talkies.
What would you have told the police if they came and busted everybody working on the film?
To tell you the truth, I was much less concerned than the people who were creating the film, and in particular the actors. One of the actors was a woman, and that's her business. And I don't know whether she would have minded very much, but the other actor was a legitimate actor from Broadway. And he was in a panic and a sweat over that possibility, because at one point it did look like some police were going to fall in on us. It wouldn't have hurt my story if they'd showed, so I didn't have any problem with the whole thing.
Does it make people nervous in a situation like that? They're trying to do it without anyone knowing that they're there, and here you are to record the experience.
It's a very tricky thing, and I don't understand exactly how people feel. I've been doing it so long, I expect some to be very casual with it and others to be worried about it. But I just go with the flow. I'm not very noticeable. I mean, I can fade in easily, and I just have a tiny pad, so I don't have to carry equipment around, be obvious that way. And I just go with it. And whatever happens, happens. And if I lose a line or two or lose a thread of the story, I'll just go on and find it somewhere else. And if some person has trouble with it, well, somebody else won't.
Has anyone ever gotten very angry at you for the way you drew them or quoted them?
I'm not sure. I'd really have to think about that. I don't think that I haven't had any major problems. I think there are people who would rather not have me around, and those are the people who don't invite me or who make sure I'm not around. So it works out.
Do you disguise people or disguise their institution?
I'll disguise people if it's appropriate. I'm not a gossip column, and I'm not out to tell stories out of school. I think the punchline ought to work even if you don't know the names. So I'll disguise when it's appropriate, and I feel that's a proper way to approach it.
Does it ever happen to you that you're talking about your life or relationships and suddenly you start to sound like a character in one of your strips?
I don't hear myself as well as you might. And people have said to me, write that down. And I think, well, what did I just say? And I'm just absolutely incapable of hearing my own quotes. I'm sure I sound just as silly as anybody else. People have said I catch the silliness, and that's why they're a little hesitant sometimes about inviting me around. But I hope it's clear that I don't think I'm any less silly than they are.
But you're never at the point where you feel absurd having a conversation afraid that someone else will eavesdrop on what you're saying in, for instance, a restaurant.
People don't do what I do. I don't know whether I'm less I'm interested in the less important things than most people. I tend to hear the sillier things. I don't know. But people will say to me, you should have been with me last night in this movie line, for example. But they don't write it down. They wait for me to come into the movie line and write it down very often. And in the same way, they're not listening to my quotes.
Do you think of yourself as being like a novelist in a way, picking up on dialogue?
I didn't start out as a writer. I started out as a purely visual person and not even very sophisticated that way. So I don't know exactly what I do. I've been told by writers that my techniques are similar to theirs, writers and reporters. In fact, maybe more reporters than writers, although I'm beginning to get a little bit more sophisticated and I'm beginning to shape these things more than I used to. But I have been told the techniques are very similar.
How close to reality do you feel obliged to keep it?
The way I do it is I write down only what I hear and as much as I'm inclined to write by some little voice in my head that says, write this down, but don't write that down. I don't know the difference at the time. But I just have a good time. I'll go in, hang in, stay in. I feel that I'll stay. Where other people will hit and run, I'll hang in for that last quote.
I forget which cartoon it was, but I remember saying to a friend of mine, do you really think he overheard that? I mean, I can't imagine. I bet he made this one up, but you never do.
I never do. I will edit. I use the word verbatim. Somebody stuck it on the strip real early, right at the beginning at The Voice. And I've heard discussions about what's appropriate to be called verbatim and what isn't. In fact, what I do is take the raw material I write down and I edit it and move it around so that what I see as the punchline might have occurred in the middle. I'll move it to the end. If somebody wants to take issue with my choice of the word verbatim, I understand that. I don't know exactly, you know, what to say about that.
Stan Mack is my guest if you're just joining us, and his strip in The Village Voice is called Stan Mack's Real Life Funnies. You sometimes have either yourself or a surrogate for yourself in the strip, and do you want to describe how you draw that person?
Sure. He's the way I always thought of myself. People have said, you don't look like that. He's a short, usually pudgy, but not always. His weight varies from week to week. Guy with a kind of a fat nose and a mustache and dark hair. And I've said that I think that if all of us were asked to draw ourselves, we might draw something that our friends would think was a little strange. But anyway, that character is how I see myself in a silly sort of way. I don't mean to be too serious about this. Plus the fact that I had a mustache when I started the comic strip. I don't have one now. And my hair is a lot grayer. But otherwise, that character is me. And he's also a device. To carry a story, it helps to have to have it clear that some of the words are being spoken to somebody. Sometimes it was me, sometimes it wasn't, but if I'm there, it works. And he's just a device to make the storyline work a little bit simpler.
Sometimes you'll have dialogue from like a bedroom. How do you know what's happening in there? Unless people assume that it's you, and maybe it is.
Well, an example is the last 2 weeks when I had a two-part story about a man and a woman in her bedroom. And it went on in the bedroom for 1 week and then downstairs in the front of the apartment house the next week. And it was a real mini soap opera. In fact, I wasn't there, obviously, but he is a good friend of mine. And I sat down with him. He was quite willing to talk to me for as long as I wanted. And I had him reconstruct the dialogue. And then I dramatized it. I made it happen in the place where it actually happened. So occasionally I'll do that. I find more and more I'm not content to catch the one-liners, which is the way the strip started, in places like singles bars, and want to have a bit more plot. Well, that means having to fish around for material in a little bit different way than in the early days.
So you set your alarm in the morning and get up and figure out some place to go to eavesdrop?
I have, for a long time, the voice was a hobby. I had a commercial art career going, and that's where I made my money. And it was a struggle to keep it up, and I never believed I was actually going to deliver the following week. It was done quite casually. But I have always delivered, and more it's taken over my life, so that this simple little occasional fantasy has become the lifestyle. And now I do the voice strip, and I do another one for an advertising magazine in New York called Adweek, which is a kind of a mini version. It means hanging out in places like advertising agencies and commercial shoots and things like that. And look for freelance versions of these things. For example, there's a page I just did in Channels Magazine, just coming out now, where I sat in a man's office. He's a syndicator of television programming. He's well known in the business. He's a real super salesman, almost outsized. And he was pushing a program which is now going on the air around the country in syndication. And I simply sat and took notes and then turned it into a page comic strip in a way, without panels, really. Almost more Pfeiffer-esque in the sense that the pictures and the words stayed by themselves. And but unlike with The Voice and Adweek, the point was to name the man and name the program. So I had to be very careful. The drawing is a caricature of him, and the words are what he said, and we had to be sure that he couldn't take issue with it. Anyway, that was a nice freelance assignment. I'd like to do a lot of those.
You said that more and more the strips and this way of working is becoming your life. Why is that?
I guess it's just a lot more fun and interesting than commercial art. One of the reasons I started was I didn't want to sit home in my little studio, as most illustrators do, and wait for an agent to bring in a commercial assignment. I'd done that for a few years, and it's okay for a while. But then you want to go on to, I want to go on to what I thought was more important things. So this is better. I don't know where it can go. I wish I were a more creative writer. But it's evolving, and I'll never not be an artist. I'll always be primarily an artist. But that's the direction.
You worked at the New York Times for several years as an art director. Right. Why are they so opposed to comics?
I don't know in the higher levels how they view this. And I never had the option, never came up on my level. But it's true, they've never originated a cartoon or carried any syndicated cartoons. They'll run collections. Now in the review, they'll run a collection of political cartoons from around the country. I think I assume they feel that a newspaper of record shouldn't be doing that kind of thing. And I don't know how I feel about it. I worked there for 5 years on and off. I had a lot to do with the changes of design in the various sections. I worked for the man who did the redesign. And I can't say that I'm sure that they should run their own cartoons.
Do you read newspaper cartoons?
I'm like the average person. I have some that are my favorites. I grew up reading comic books and newspaper cartoons. I'm not an average reader of them. I think of the ones that are around in my daily paper. I like Doonesbury, and I like Andy Capp. But I don't pay much attention to, and I guess Peanuts, because that man is brilliant. I think he was truly innovative at one time. Now, maybe less so, but those three.
What about the New Yorker cartoons?
I don't have a subscription, but I read the New Yorker cartoons every time I get my hands on a New Yorker. And I think I'd say my favorites were, among my favorites are Booth and Corin. They're fine. They're wonderful. Sometimes I wish that they showed more of real New York life, and maybe that's just because of where I'm coming from. I think that they show New York as seen from Stamford, Connecticut very often, or in the case of Ed Koren, from the Upper West Side, but you don't see garbage in the streets. You don't see a lot of real New York. But otherwise, I think they're wonderful.
Do people call you up a lot and invite you out?
Not very much at all. And for a long time, I did it because I enjoyed it, not because I thought anybody read it or knew who I was or what I was doing. And I traveled in a kind of a vacuum for a long time. I would go places I felt like going. Sometimes there were places where the public could go. Every once in a while, I would talk somebody into letting me go backstage someplace. But it was all very individual and lonely even. Now, more people know who I am, and occasionally somebody will say, why don't you come by? But not as much as you might imagine.
How do you talk someone into letting you backstage? Because that's a difficult place to get.
It is, and some places I can't get. For example, backstage in a theater is tricky, or rehearsals for theatrical production are tricky, but I'll catch something here or there. A few weeks ago, I did go to a rehearsal for a Pfeiffer play, in fact, and it was funny and silly, and I knew the people, I knew the director, and it was done one Sunday afternoon in her own home, so it was so casual that there was no problem.
How'd you get into the audio control room for the Billy Joel concert?
I know Billy Joel was having a film made of his concert. I know the director. And he asked me if I would like to come by. So I just stood next to him and watched him direct the cameras and make a film.
What did they think of the strip?
They all enjoyed it, even though the punchline turned out to be the producers caring more about audience reaction than the art connected with what my friend was doing. A lot of people discover afterwards they enjoy it. And sometimes I think that the people who are at the event I cover have more fun with it than the average reader can. It's odd. This thing that I do is very strange, and I don't understand it. While in some ways it might have the same audience as Gary Trudeau might, for example, it's very different and could never go out across the country the way his does. It has its niche. But I'm just saying, I don't know how it's perceived in generally.
Well, I think most people overhear conversations and feel that there's something so absurd about what they're hearing, and your strip is so much, or many of them, is so much about that, but that feeling of just overhearing something really bizarre that's perfectly ordinary happening.
It is that combination. Sometimes I think one of the criticisms might be that it's simply ordinary. It's not bizarre enough to make the punchline work the way a writer would make a punchline work. And I don't know if that's, in the long run, maybe that's okay. But I've heard it as criticism.
You were the co-author of a new book of comics called In Search of the G-Spot. What's the story behind that book?
I was approached by a writer and agent who thought that it was a hot idea for the cartoon market. The G-Spot book was coming out, and people had high hopes that they were going to make a lot of money from it. So they said, in a sense, let's rip it off and make some money. And I'm not against that, and they were giving me complete freedom to play around with the idea. And sex is something that it's fun to make fun with, so I had no problem with any of that. I didn't really feel that it was a great idea, but I went with it anyway. What happened was that it didn't do well. I don't think the original G-Spot book did as well as
I think that was on the bestseller list for several weeks.
Was it?
I think so.
Well, somehow, at least up till now, the book hasn't caught on. And that's the roll of the dice. I don't know how people gauge the public's interest in things like this. But we did it, and I had fun doing it. And in a way, it was a one-joke book. How many different ways can you come up with that idea? I never read the original book, and half the jokes in there are sex jokes more than G-spot jokes, although we always try to slant in that direction.
There's a lot of alphabet jokes in there.
There was a lot of alphabet jokes. So we put in all kinds of silly titles for other imaginary G-spot books as a way of tying it in.
So when people do meet you, do they think that you're the Stan Mack that they expected to find?
Usually not. In the same way, people don't know what you look like and create their own images. People read the comic strip and expect me to be stranger looking than I really am. I'm quite ordinary looking, but they want somebody who's scruffy and lives in a loft in the East Village and staggers out of his building once a week to grab hold of a story and get it up to the voice in time. And it's a cute image, and I get a kick out of it. I used to say that I shouldn't be doing this thing. The one who should be doing it is that guy, except that he hasn't volunteered, and so here I am.
Do you think of yourself as being mainstream?
I would have said yes. I'm sure anybody I grew up with, adults or friends, would have said that. Just laid back mainstream. But if I look back over the work I've created instead of the image I present, it's not at all mainstream. Starting with Mule's Diner, which was in the early years of the Lampoon, these things have a very individualistic and oddball character.
Do you ever hang around the offices of the Village Voice, for whom you write, and eavesdrop on conversations there between the writers and editors?
They're as aware of me, I think, as people on the outside. So they may face the other direction if I happen to be in the neighborhood. But if anything floats over my cubby, I'll write it down, and it has on occasion. It's a good place in a sense because they reflect, I think, our audience. Then their concerns are the concerns of the audience, so it works.
Do people, your own friends, ever say, okay, this is off the record, and tell you what's on their mind, but want the assurance first that you're not going to quote them?
Occasionally, some people have said, this is off the record. People are a lot more sophisticated today, so it's not just the people in the media who will do that, but they might.
Do you respect that?
Oh, sure. I play it as straight as I can. I don't play around. It's not necessary to fool around. I'll try to avoid hearing that line if I think I'm onto a story. Usually it's okay, and I can make that work.
Well, I've enjoyed meeting you, and I really enjoy Real Life Funnies. Thanks a lot for being here.
Thanks for inviting me.
Stan Mack has been my guest, and you can read his strip weekly in the Village Voice. It's called Stan Mack's Real Life Funnies. And again, if you just tuned in, it's drawn and based on conversations that he's overheard. And the situations range from the perfectly ordinary to the really bizarre. And you can see it every week in the Village Voice. He's also the co-author of a new book of sex spoof jokes called In Search of the G-Spot.